Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. Joining me this week is Gio Manry, Associate Editor. Hey Gio.
Hey, how you doing?
And super special surprise guest from Vertical, Ed Chavez. Hey Ed.
Hey, thanks for having me. I know it was really, really last minute, so...
Thanks. Hey, we're super excited to have you on. You have some news that you wanted to share.
Yeah, we do.
Which we always love on this show. So, do we want to start with that right up front? What's going on?
I guess this is something that's kind of special to ANN in particular. I remember, what was it, last year at Anime Expo, there was this sudden surge of demand for a specific title. Do you remember what that was?
I do. I think I know what you're talking about. It was just an overwhelming outpour of sudden thirst for a very specific Tezuka title. But I don't think I can remember which one it was.
She is bloody goddamned huge all over the world.
I don't know. It's a title that was just, huge everywhere and had so many fans for so many generations.
Indeed. What up?
After listening to so much enthusiasm in that recording, Vertical just had to jump on the opportunity to finally pick up the license for Princess Knight.
Hell yeah!
Wow, Princess Knight. Ribon no Kishi. Chapa Yunde Princessa.
Yeah.
Etc. Etc.
Yes.
Princess Knight, Ribon no Kishi, Chapiundi Princessin, etc. etc. etc.
I am super excited for this. Me to say, I think I was one of those people demanding it at Expo. Probably.
Uh huh. Like one of three people or something.
Well, that's cool though. So that's really cool.
It is really cool. I mean, it's a property that as you guys know, it is a beloved title. It is a title that has had longevity globally. Is it exactly Tezuka's best title? Are there thousands of people, even in America that are demanding the title every day? Maybe not. But it's definitely a very important Tezuka title. And after doing some other properties that may not have been on people's radar from Tezuka, like Ayako or Ode Kirihiro, we thought long and hard and finally decided to give the fans what they want. And after doing Blackjack, we thought it would be really easy to finally share a little bit of shoujo from the godfather of manga.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about how it's not necessarily the most requested title, but I've certainly heard plenty of people talking about it in the sort of short list of Tezuka works they want brought over or translated into English.
Yeah,
that's definitely one of them. I wouldn't call it an obscure work by him by any means.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, in general, I think the three of us can say that outside of Blackjack and maybe Dororo, most of the Tezuka titles that we've been taking on have not necessarily been on Westerners' radar. Yeah, Buddha is really important, like in Japan, but Princess Knight is something that we know is extremely significant in the Tezuka canon. Mm-hmm. And after just weighing the options and listening to Tezuka Productions, ever since I joined Vertical, they've been saying, when are you guys going to do Ribon no Kishi? When are you guys going to do Ribon no Kishi? And after just kind of weighing the options and looking at the fact that we had a big gap for Tezuka at the end of the year, we said, why not finally, take him on that offer? And we're going to be, we're really excited. We're going to be releasing a 2-volume edition at the end of the year, and we really, really hope that fans, not just in the States but globally, will come to embrace Ribon no Kishi, Princess Knight, in this new Vertical adaptation.
So, if I could ask real quick, do you know yet whether you're really going to be aiming sort of at the high-end adult manga historian kind of market, or if you're going to try and reach out more to other shoujo readers? I mean, have you got any decisions made on that kind of thing yet?
You know, that's a really good question, Gia, because it's something that we were really debating up until last week. We were really going for what are our Tezuka readers, you know, the people who read Buddha, the people who read Ayako or Mu. So we were going to do, and we were initially going to do a big 700-page omnibus, velvet cover in purple and pink.
Wow.
But after speaking with some vendors, after speaking with Random House, our distributor, everybody that we shared Princess Knight with was so on board that they were like, you know, we want more. We can't have just one volume. Can you give us three volumes? Can you at least give us two volumes so we can, really share this with traditional shoujo fans? And after a little bit of debate and, discussing this with the people in Japan, we thought, if all of the vendors here think that's a possibility, and we're definitely not opposed to it here in the vertical offices, why not give the fans what they want? And we'll be doing a two volume edition, 350 pages or so. The price point's going to be a little nicer. It's going to be $13.95, which is pretty nice for 380 pages and 350 pages. It's going to be the same trim size as most of our other Tezuka, but it's going to be a little more accessible, and we're definitely going to try to market it towards shoujo fans, at least initially. Eventually, we'll possibly reconsider that hardcover edition to try to go after the academia and the highbrow section of
the collectors,
the sector of Tezuka fans that are out there. But
yeah, I was going to say, if you release that pretty velvet box, I'd buy it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what we were expecting either way, but after discussing it with particularly with Random House, they were like, they do see potential there for teens and tweens and maybe even people who don't traditionally read manga as well, which is basically what Vertical does normally. So. Mm-hmm. We're really excited about that.
Cool.
Well, I know at least one guy who's really happy about this announcement. I'm sure you've made his year.
Hell yeah!
Well, hopefully, like, gets in touch with you guys, because I mean, I can honestly say that even after your suggestion to for him to get in touch with Vertical, I never got an email or a tweet or snail mail or anything. We did make this decision mainly from our discussions with Tezuka Productions, as well as talking to our vendors. So, we're definitely aware that there are fans out there. We will really like to see them come out and support the title when it launches in October.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's really cool. So, I did want to ask, since we've got you here. How was 2010 for Vertical? How'd you guys do last year, and how are things looking for 2011?
Yeah, our manga division really did well, particularly towards the second half of the year, and that's something I was kind of expecting the last time we talked. Part of that's mainly because we've upped our production. I mean, we used to just do one Tezuka series a year at the most, one classic series a year at the most, and we really picked that up once I started. And with releasing Cheese Sweet Home, which is a New York Times bestseller, 7 Billion Needles, which has been flirting with those rankings for a while, Twin Spica, which has been on a bunch of awards, and best graphic novelists over the year. And even Pipochu. I mean, Pipochu is a weird title, but it has found its niche though. So, I think people have figured out what Vertical's content is like, and you know, they're kind of really running with it, not just readers, but also vendors now. And, you know, we're really happy to be able to do more of that in the future. So, like this year, we'll be releasing books by Usamaru Furuya, the guy who created Shortcuts, Matsumura Jiro, the guy who did Velveteen and Mandala, and a couple of other titles for Shogakukan. You know, we're going to continue to do some, you know, edgy stuff, some seinen stuff. Stuff that you kind of would see from Dark Horse. I think we're very similar in that way, but not necessarily presenting this just for, you know, the traditional manga readership. Putting it out for everybody. So yeah. So, you know, outside of, you know, those two titles and Mubu no Kishi, we've got another property that we'll be releasing at the end of the year, which is another very vertical type of title. The Drops of God, which is known in Japan as Kamen no Shizuku. Pretty infamous because it's a title that influenced, you know, wine sales globally. And, you know, it's not necessarily the type of title that you normally see from anybody, really. And I guess neither was Chi or neither was Pipochu. But, you know, for us, that title, it's exactly vertical. It's modern Japanese pop culture, you know, at its height and at its most extreme in some ways. And, you know, we're really excited, you know, to have that opportunity, you know, working with Kodansha on this and working with my old friends at Morning as well, just kind of bringing together all those connections that I've made in the years.
So I will admit to being ignorant about Drops of God. Never heard of it. But obviously it's about wine. What's the story?
Yeah, it's actually about a beer salesman whose dad is Japan's premier wine critic. And while the guy's kind of doing his rounds, he gets a random call from someone he doesn't know. And unfortunately, it's a call to let him know that his father had passed away. And he has to go home. He hasn't gone home for a while. He gets there. He's, you know, getting ready to, you know, hear out the final will and testament and you know, fill out whatever papers he needs to take his claim to the estate. When all of a sudden he's introduced to another person who apparently is his new adopted brother. His dad, this wine critic, was aware that his son wasn't a wine aficionado, so he wasn't going to leave this really vast wine collection to someone who wasn't going to appreciate it. So he set up this contest between Shizuku, the main character, and Issei, this new brother he just met, who is also a wine critic. The two have to find 12 wines that are essentially sent from heaven, literally in this case, or I guess figuratively in this case, because, you know, dad is in heaven at this time. And so these two, you know, 20 somethings crisscross the globe looking for really rare exotic wines that capture the moment in a very specific way. And the funny thing about the Drops of God is that every time the two main characters like take a sip of wine, the comic artist renders their that moment, that taste, that flavor, in really elaborate images. So, like, the first wine that the main character ever drinks, the first glass he ever drinks, is realized in an image of a Queen rock concert. And he feels the voice of Freddie Mercury and with every sip. And yeah, most of the chapters are just as ridiculous, but they're also pretty poignant. I mean, you really get to learn quite a bit about wine culture quite a bit about, about the way that the Japanese are starting to really come into their own with this culture right now. Because it's not, I mean, you know, they're not in Europe. They're not necessarily making, you know, high-end wines over there. They're kind of just figuring this out, you know, from a secondary, tertiary perspective. But, you know, the writers are huge wine aficionados. They've been interviewed by Decanter and Wine Aficionado magazine. They know their stuff, and they're bringing it to a culture that is actually hungry for this type of content. And we first started reading Kaminitsu's Drops of God. We thought it was hilarious. We thought it was really different, and we thought it was going to be a challenge. And after, debating it for a while, we were like, this is a challenge that I think the vertical should take, and one that we feel people are going to be really surprised by when we release it this year.
That definitely sounds like one of those titles that gets written about in a mainstream sort of literature press.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you guys publish a lot of that sort of thing, for sure. But I get what you mean when you say totally a vertical. Sounds like a vertical title. I couldn't think of another publisher.
Yeah, I know a lot of foodies who are going to buy it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Zach, is that already, I mean, the book hasn't been translated into English, and CNN, Reuters, the New York Times, the Times of London, they've all written up this book because of the financial economic impact it's had.
Right.
When a new wine is introduced in this book, like, wine sales globally skyrocket.
Wow.
People all across Asia are buying these wines. It's extremely relevant. And while we don't necessarily think, there's going to be that type of frenzy here in the West, because I think people are a little more cynical, or at least are a little more familiar with wine. We do think that, we are definitely going to get, write-ups in mainstream media for this title, because it's just so smart and it's so different. Mm-hmm.
You guys should do some kind of promotional partnership where you have little tag advertisements on bottles of wine in, like, the grocery store. That'd be awesome.
See, actually, I was thinking that you would, like, finally actually get one of those little wine samplers with the manga, but, I mean, I guess labels are cool, too.
Yeah, we were planning on doing some little wine tastings at conventions, so hopefully I'll be able to see the two of you not just read Kaminitsu, but also sip some of the wines, and maybe San Diego Comic-Con or New York Comic-Con.
I am all over that.
Double.
Cool.
Okay, man. Well, so it sounds like things are going good at Vertical. What's your first quarter looking like? What have you guys got coming out? Anything you want to plug?
For the first quarter, we're a little heavy on novels, so which is something that we've been neglecting for a little while. We'll be releasing a book called City of Refuge by essentially our godfather, Kenzo Kitagawa. It's a an adventure, action, mystery title about a thug who ends up getting deeper and deeper into trouble every time he meets youth. First, she ends up dating a person who was lying about her age, gets him into deep doo doo. Then he ends up dealing with a little kid he runs into at a playground. All of a sudden, the cops think he kidnapped this child, and things don't end up turning out very well for him. Then we're going to be releasing a new book by Beat Takeshi called A Guru Is Born. This is actually based off of a movie that he produced in the 90s. Essentially a comedy about Japanese cults and how they try to scam people, essentially bumpkins, out of their money. That's really hilarious, and we're just in the process of sending it off to the printers. As I said before, we're going to be releasing works by Usamaru Fuya. So the Light to Light Club will be coming out in April. A very, very edgy, very violent, very sexy title about teens with troubles finding girls. So instead, they build a robot to take care of that for them.
Naturally,
I guess the opposite of Evangelion. And we've got a couple of other quirky titles, cookbooks and puzzle books, same old vertical. But yeah, things will really start picking up in the summer. We've got a lot more Tezuka and some more zombie titles coming out.
Oh, those are always exciting. Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up. Thanks so much for coming on and sharing your exciting news with us. I really do appreciate it. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Sure
thing. And I'll hope to see you guys this summer at a wine tasting or comic reading.
Or both.
Perhaps both at the same time.
Or both.
Drunken comic readings. Sold.
Yeah, definitely. We'll see you this summer, man. Take care.
All right.
Okay, well, that was cool.
Indeed.
Thanks, Ted, for dropping by. So, you've been going to the movies lately.
I've been going to the movies, except for Gantz.
Except for Gantz. Wow, lucky you.
Yeah, no, I had kind of this big Funimation / Yoshiyuki Sadamoto weekend, since he's the guy who did character design for both Evangelion 2.0 and Summer Wars, which I saw both of over the weekend. A lot of fun, obviously. I thought Summer Wars was kind of an interesting screening because it was part of a kids' festival. So almost everybody in the audience was either a Funimation employee, part of my little group of friends, or like eight. And kind of adorable. Actually, they were very well-behaved theater goers. And it was really fun to see them kind of really getting into it. I don't know how much, because some of them were actually pretty young, so I don't know how much they really kind of understood what was going on, but it was really fun to see them kind of gasping at all the visual effects and things like that, and oohing and aahing and doing all those things that we as grown-ups would like not be caught dead doing anymore.
That's cool.
Especially the little kid behind me. Every time they did like an establishing shot or, you know, a shot where nothing's really happening on the screen, the kid behind me goes, I'm scared. That's adorable and silly.
Oh my gosh. That's really weird. Yeah, it's not really a kid's movie, but.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like, sitting there watching it, kind of trying to think about what kids would think about it. I mean, I know at that age, I would not have understood what was going on. At the same time, there's nothing like particularly objectionable in it, except for a little bit of swearing. So, I would definitely aim it more at kind of like the at least 12 and up kind of range to really appreciate it. But
yeah,
there's a lot of pretty things. So
right, and kids like cartoons. So, well, that's interesting. So, you saw it dubbed?
Yes, Summer Wars was dubbed.
And how was the dub?
I actually thought, I'm not much of a dub person, but I thought the dub for Summer Wars was really great. I thought I didn't memorize the cast list or anything, but I especially thought that whoever it was playing the grandmother did a fantastic job with that. I just loved that character so much. I had an unfortunate thing where at the very beginning of the movie, one of my friends leans over to me and says, "Dean!" So the entire rest of the movie, listening to the main character, I, of course, hear Dean Venture, who is, of course, voiced by Michael Cinder-Nicholas. Yeah, that was a little weird. But it didn't ruin the movie, so that's good.
Yeah, I kind of find that annoying. He's a really talented voice actor. I can pick him out, but he's better than many other people who do anime dubs. They don't seem to have very much range, and they don't really do voices. They just talk. And they're not bad performers, but they're no Rob Paulsen or you know what I'm saying. They're not like, they don't have a huge amount of range. I can always tell it's Vic Mignogna, you know?
Right. I was watching Princess Tutu the other day, and there's this episode with this character who shows up, and he's this, of course, ridiculously flamboyant prince who saves himself, not being saved by Princess Tutu. He saves himself from the antagonist by his enormous ego. And I look it up, and sure enough, that was Vic Mignogna.
Oh, Vic. Yeah, so, well, that's cool. That's one of those movies I wouldn't necessarily want to watch dubbed, because my general rule is if there are Japanese people in Japan, I want to watch it subtitled, because why would they be speaking English? It's a weird rule that I have, but it's a very Japanese movie, so.
Yeah, but they clearly put a lot of effort into it. I mean, I think they really brought their A game, and so I was really able to enjoy it, even with the dub. Yeah, although I'll definitely watch it subtitled when I get the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing the dub on the Blu-ray. That's how I will check that out. Now, so you also saw Eva 2.0.
I also saw Eva 2.0. Very different experience because it's an ongoing showing. Just one of our major Megaplex theaters. Actually, a whole bunch of theaters in the Dallas-Fort Worth area are showing it. Partially, I think, since Funimation's kind of here.
Yeah, I was about to say, uh-huh.
But so we drove out to the nearest one to us, and, you know, they had, like, four different showings on Sunday. So there were only, like, six people in the theater, maybe. No, eight people. That includes us four who went to see it. So a lot less of kind of energy in the room, so to speak. But, man, I really, really – that was subtitled, and I really, really enjoyed it. I've never been like that big of an Evangelion fan, but I was really getting into this. We were having all these discussions afterwards. Oh, we thought this meant and that meant, and I'm like, oh no, now I'm that Evangelion fan. sort of. Mostly we were talking about Asuka in the new iteration.
You know, that doesn't surprise me because that movie kicks ass. It's really good. I think it will make a lot of people Evangelion fans if they're not already fans, because the action is so good. It's so well done. It's an exciting fucking movie. Like, it's really good. I just loved it, and I'm happy that they're putting effort into a nice little theatrical run. You know, it's just an advertisement for the DVD, but this is a really cool time. I'm really happy that Funimation's putting all this stuff into theaters, and I don't know why they're doing it in January, but I guess it's nice that there's something to do during the dead of winter.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's less competition makes it a little easier to sell it. I don't know. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's showing for like a week, and on some of the days they're showing 1.0 and 2.0 like back-to-back, which is kind of cool. For people who aren't familiar with the series already, they can sit there and watch like 6 hours of it, well, 4 hours of it, whatever.
4.5 hours, yeah.
Yeah, it would be a little much for me. We showed 1.0 to a friend who hadn't seen any of it yet, like the day before instead. Mm-hmm. Thanks for spacing that out a little. But yeah, also we had a hint, thanks to having been at that Summer Wars presentation, to stay through the credits, and not just for the preview for the next movie. There's stay through the credits.
Okay. Well, people, that's stay through the credits. I have to admit, I am not even very curious about the dub that they're doing for that, and just me. I'm a big Evangelion fan, and I've always hated the Evangelion dub. I think they did a better job on 1.0, but to be perfectly frank, the fact that they got Tiffany Grant again to do Asuka does not excite me. I was really hoping they were going to get somebody new for that. No offense to Tiffany, just not a fan of that performance. So I guess I'll see when the Blu-ray eventually comes out, but yeah, it's good you saw it subtitled. I think that's the way to see it.
Yeah.
My personal opinion.
I mean, again, if we're talking about Japanese people in Japan, that's technically about, although I have to tell you, Kaji is the worst English speaker ever. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. Although, the only thing about that movie that I was like, okay, guys, was the Mari character.
Yeah.
Clearly added in for character merchandise.
Absolutely, but I really like her character design, and she's kind of psycho, so I'm totally cool with it.
Right.
Oh, is that a spoiler? Sorry.
Well, if you look at the standard Evangelion, there really is no boobs and glasses character girl, so they really needed one of those for the modern anime crowd.
Hey, at least she's not, like, I don't know, 11 years old, or looks like she's 11 years old, or anything like that. You know,
hey,
I mean, that's,
I'm with you on that. I don't think she's a distraction or anything. Her action scenes are really cool, but she may as well have just had a price tag slapped on her ass.
I want to see somebody edit that into the movie, just every scene she's in.
1999,
price tag moving around.
So the thing I've been watching is Kara no Kyokai, the Garden of Sinners. I have the only screener copy that exists.
Wow.
Aniplex only has, it's a $400 box set.
Right.
So Aniplex has one set of check discs. They sent it to Chris Beveridge. He reviewed it. I got it next. So when I'm done, I guess I'll be sending it back to them and they can send it along to the next critic. It's been a long time since anything like this has happened. Usually they make more than one, but I can understand in this case it's seven Blu-rays, you know. So I got through the first movie. Have you seen any of this?
No, all I know about it is like the stark raving mad ramblings of a massive Type Moon fan I'm in a chat room with sometimes. That's like everything I know about it right there.
Yeah. Are you a fan of Tight Moon?
I was not a big Fates Day Night fan. I've never played any of the games, so I could not, in all honesty, say that I'm a fan. I don't hate them.
Yeah, you know, I don't hate them either. But the only thing of theirs that I've seen more than one or two episodes of was Tsukihime, which was years ago at this point. And the reason I only saw a couple episodes of that is because I thought it was boring. And I find their stuff does not necessarily excite me. I think their character designs, while they're pretty, I don't think they're particularly, they don't stand out. Like, they're not very distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of boring. Character designs are kind of boring. And this is very much like Tight Moon to the hilt. It's all over it. I guess it's based on a series of books that got turned into a doujinshi, that got turned into a series of movies, and now these movies are really popular. I have to
admit, didn't Del Rey release like the first chapter of the novel or something like that, and we're going to release the novels and they never did it or something?
Maybe. I couldn't tell you. I didn't see that in the little bit of research I did. Because I walked into this cold. I knew absolutely nothing about the movies before I started watching them, and then after I got about halfway through the first one and said, hey, what the fuck is going on? I went on to our encyclopedia and checked around and learned a little bit more about the series. And while I couldn't tell you what it's about yet, because I guess I'm only a little bit into the second movie. I got to watch these over this weekend and write the review. Basically, it's like supernatural murder mystery type of thing with a girl who has artificial limbs and there's ghosts and shit. It's,
wow.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, anime that is vague and mysterious on purpose. Like, ooh, what's going on? And
yeah.
For some reason, there's a lot of anime series, B-Train, Type Moon, I guess. They like to wallow in the, what's going on? It's so spooky and mysterious. And they do it for way too long, to the point where I lose interest, and I'm like, okay, guys, I don't really care what the hell's going on in your spooky little ghost story, because you won't tell me. So that's the way the first movie is. I got through it, and at the end I was like, huh. But apparently somebody on Twitter told me that movies 2 and 3 explain more of the backstory, which is fine. I look forward to seeing if it clears up at all. But it's very pretty. The animation's very nice, certainly theatrical quality. And the soundtrack is really good. The music is really cool. So
nice.
I didn't get the final package. I didn't get the big fancy box. I got 7 discs and jewel cases. So I don't know if this is final product or not, but they are pretty bare bones. There's a menu, a little pop-up menu, subtitled in English. Subtitles seem fine to me. But based on what I'm seeing on these discs, not really loaded up with special features or anything. So we'll see if by the end of 7 movies, I'll make a determination as to whether or not this is going to be worth, based on content alone, your $400.
Yeah.
So
I'm purely curious about it because, you know, they're doing this premiere screening thing in San Francisco. And at that, they are showing movies 1, 2, and 7.
Yeah.
And that confuses me. Either it's episodic enough that that's reasonable, or they're really just going to skip over 4 movies worth of important content. I'm a little confused by the whole thing, but I guess we'll see how that turns out.
I don't know yet. From what I can tell, it's a serial. These are basically long, really long episodes of a 7-episode TV series.
Well, and they get longer, right? Like, the first movie is only like 45 minutes or 50 minutes or something, but by the end, like, the 7th movie is like 2 hours long or something like that.
This is not... It's not that I'm not curious about it, but anytime anyone says, here, watch these 7 films, you're like, okay, how long do I have to do this?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit.
I do not envy you.
It's a bit much. But I'll get through it. And it is definitely one release that I'm more curious about than others. So I'm happy that they sent it along.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. Like, with a $400 price tag, you're like, well, what is it?
We haven't seen a release priced this way, I don't think, ever. In the history of anime in the U.S. It used to be,
super
expensive.
I can think
of
a couple of box sets that were, like, an entire, several season series that were kind of expensive, but...
Well, back in the day, the original Trigun box, I think, was, like, $150, $200. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was... For a long time, I remember the price point being at $120. Of course, now you can get the whole thing for $19.98 or whatever, but... Yeah, premium releases were in the $100 to $200 range, but that was in 2001, 2002.
Right.
So this is new and different, and it's very interesting. So I wanted to bring this up very briefly, but Wizard closed its doors. The magazine was shuttered, along with Toy Fair at Garib Sheamus Enterprises, and I worked there for 2 years or so. And I just wanted to say that I feel bad for the guys that lost their jobs. Those guys were awesome. Editorial at Wizard, those people were solid gold people. I loved them. And I wish them all the best. And, yeah, so I just wanted to kind of throw that out there that it's at the end of an era. I read Wizard when I was a kid, and it was kind of a dream to work there when I did eventually get to work there. And it was a downstairs, as they call it, which downstairs was where all the editorial guys were. Upstairs were all the dick-headed managers were. Nobody liked management at Wizard. That was always the rule. Everybody, editorial all got along, but management, it doesn't surprise me that this is happening, and I would not advise anybody to buy stock in Wizard World LLC or whatever it's called. But those are really solid guys, and everybody I knew that worked there that moved on before it shut down moved on to insanely greener pastures. As we know, Bricken runs toplessrobot.com. He's had huge success with that. I mean, for Doug Goldstein, who was my boss there, he's the head writer on Robot Chicken. And Zach Oat, who was the editor at Toy Fair, he runs Television Without Pity now.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah. I mean, these were insanely talented guys. Mm-hmm. And they all moved on to do great things. And that place was a factory for talented folks. I will not include myself in that description, but it was a great place. I'm really sad to see them go. I just wanted to mention that briefly. So the other little bit of news is Funimation is suing pirates, which I don't really have that much. I don't really have that much to say about it. I mean, okay, very cute with the number thing. It's clearly a publicity thing. It's clearly a show of strength to Japan. I'm going to wager. Mm-hmm. It's a show of strength for their Japanese partners.
Right.
Is that sort of your read on it?
I don't really have a read on it because I'm just so not up on any kind of like corporate politics, anything. I was a little surprised to see that Funimation sued. I always kind of figured if anybody did it, it was going to start out with Viz, but I didn't really have any basis for that, I guess. That's really all I got.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not going to do anything, but every other major entertainment media, form of entertainment media, this has happened. It's newsworthy, but I don't necessarily know that it's anything to get all worked up about. But, of course, there's 250 posts about it in the forums already, so
there you naturally.
Of course. Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up. What do you think?
I think I want to hear what Deb and Ed have to say.
Okay, then. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to that.
I didn't know that Vertigo did Tezuka Publications.
Not Vertigo, Vertical.
Vertical, I didn't know they even existed. I've
been Tezuka fan, hunting.
Okay, we're back. My guest this week, coming back for a second round of manga chat, is Ed Sizemore from ComicsWorthReading.com and the Manga Out Loud podcast, which I believe is just mangaoutloud.com. Correct, Ed?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay, Ed, thanks for coming back on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And also, Deb Aoki from the manga editor at About.com. Deb, thanks for coming back.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking me back.
All right, guys. So 2010. I know you both sort of participated in Best of 2010, at least chatter, if not articles. And my manga reading in 2010 was pretty limited. So I'm curious to know, what should I have been reading in 2010? And Ed, let's start with you.
Well, let's see. The one that I'm, I always talk about ended in 2010, which is Pluto, and then Urasawa's other manga, which is still running right now, is 20th Century Boys, and in fact, the last two have been killer because he is really kind of up the ante on his cliffhangers a lot. The other ones, actually, that came out in 2010 that I thought were really good were Twin Spica, Saturn Apartments, and I'll give it my all. A lot, any of the Sig Icky stuff I really liked in 2010, as well as anything Vertical was putting out in 2010. Those were always kind of my short answers.
Okay, right. The entire Vertical is getting a lot of play on this podcast. And actually, Jason Thompson's House of 1,000 Manga this week is Buddha, So I guess it's vertical week this week at ANN.
I guess it is.
Deb, what about you?
I thought I really was impressed by A Drunken Dream by Moto Hagio. I thought that was really an interesting book. I was really happy to see that one come out because that was very much the kind of thing that, you know, like your Viz, your Tokyopop wouldn't put out. So it took something like someone like Fantagraphics to do it.
Right.
So I thought that was a great thing to see. I love Cross Game, Mitsuru Adachi's sports manga. Again, another creator that everyone in Japan loves but hasn't really not gotten a lot of play here. I enjoyed Bunny Drop a lot. That was very about a 30-year-old man who suddenly becomes the father of a 5-year-old girl. All My Darling Daughters and Not Love But Delicious Food and Ooku from Fumiyoshi Naga all were excellent, excellent books. And of course, Cheese Sweet Home.
Right.
Which, you know, I'm a sucker for cat manga, and I think that's one of the best cat mangas out there. Ever.
I didn't realize that was an entire genre.
No, there is. I went to Japan last year, there was a whole section of just cat manga.
Wow.
It was awesome.
I remember Chris Butcher put up on his blog when he went over, he had found a whole monthly magazine that was just serialized cat manga.
Exactly, yes.
Which I thought was amazing.
It doesn't surprise me, though. The internet is proof of our global fascination with cats doing nothing.
It's true. So, why should Japan be any different?
So speaking of, I want to sort of get to this before we move on. Speaking of which, in the first segment, we had a little bit of news. Ed Chavez came on and revealed two new licenses over at Vertical, and I wanted to get your reactions to them. The first one is Osamu Tezuka's Princess Knight, which I think people have been waiting for that. What's your guys' take on that?
Yeah, this one is a big fan favorite. I mean, but it's something that Shoujo Beat, like Viz, ran in Shoujo Beat like one chapter maybe about 2 years ago, and everyone's like, oh, so where's the rest of it? And they never put it out. I think Princess Knight is considered, well, I mean, it's just like a classic shoujo manga.
Right.
So it's for kids. It's very different than what Vertical has been putting out as far as their Tezuka works, which has been mostly Tezuka's stuff for grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sentimental favorite. It's about a girl who... It's kind of like a fairy tale, really. A girl who has to, you know, dress up as a boy to protect her kingdom. It's only really been available as a bilingual edition.
Mm, yeah.
That's very, very hard to find, very out of print. So people have been asking for this for a long time. It's very, really nice to see it come out. It's one of my personal favorites because I got turned on to manga and anime by watching, because Princess Knight used to play on TV in Hawaii, the subtitled version. So this is a huge sentimental favorite for me.
Finally is my response. yeah, because this has been a very foundational work. You know, when you listen to the what Deb was saying about the girl who dresses up as a knight, that's going to sound a little bit like Rose of Versailles. You'll see homages to Princess Knight even in things like the Cardcaptor Sakura.
Mm-hmm.
When they do the play, they're dressed up as Princess Knight characters. So it's amazing. Once I knew it existed, seeing all the shoujo make references to it, or I should say a lot of the shoujo. And one of the things that really made me anxious was a few years ago, there was the traveling exhibit called the Shoujo Manga Girl Power Comics for Women. And they actually had an original Princess Knight page. And that was like one of only like 4 pages I'd ever seen from the manga. So
Wow. I
can't wait to read it.
So Ed also announced that they were planning a big velvet box release, which, you know, 750-page omnibus, mm-hmm. Which I guess would be the entire thing.
Because it is. I have the bilingual edition. It's on. I think it's like 5 or 6 volumes. They can basically put together in one omnibus edition.
Well, they're not doing that. what he said is that basically the vendors thought there was potential there because I guess their Tezuka stuff does pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to come out in like 2 or 3 volumes at like a $14 price point.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of wanted to get your guys' take on the idea of the premium release, because 2011 is quickly becoming the year of returning to the premium release in terms of, at least in terms of anime. Do you think it's this title would be served better by that proposed but ultimately not used giant velvet box omnibus, or do you think the $14 multiple volume release is better for a title like this?
I think we all know that any manga that was created before 1990 has very limited appeal with manga's main audience in America, which is teenagers.
Right.
This is mostly for collectors, I think. People who are interested in manga as an art form, manga's history, people who like Tezuka, people who like shoujo manga and are interested in its history. But I think, like your average teenage reader today who reads Ouran High School Host Club will not really be terribly interested in Princess Knight. I mean, they'll find it to look dated and the story to be a little hokey. So I totally understand why publishers like Drawn in Quarterly and Fantagraphics and Vertical put out these prestige editions, because one, it's catering to who the target audience is, which is an older manga reader, as well as taking into account that, a deluxe edition is something that you can't get by reading a scanlation. It becomes the artifact.
Right.
You
have this collector's piece that you display, and it's special. It means more to you.
Right.
Ed, what about you?
No, I agree with Deb. I think the nice part about making it probably multiple volume at a lower price point is it just makes it much more library friendly than like a big omnibus would be. So anything that gets it into libraries, I'm always really happy and supportive of. And as Deb said, unfortunately, since the majority of manga readers are going to be a younger audience who aren't really interested in anything that isn't currently running in Japan, this is probably going to be more for people like myself and the older fans who are looking for like the more historical work. So, I'm happy to get it in any edition I can get my hands on. And so two or three volumes works really well for me. I like the premium editions. It was nice to have Drunken Dream in a hardback, and Fantagraphics did a really nice job with that. And when Buddha came out initially as hardbacks, I'm actually very happy that they did that, because it's a significant work. It's nice to put up on the bookshelf. It looks nice, and I also know it's going to last forever. So. I do like the vertical hardcovers, because I think they wear well, as well as just being almost works of art in their own right, because they've done a really good design job on their books.
Right. Okay. So the other license that they've got that he announced was this. Apparently, it's a bit of a phenomenon. He referred to it as infamous, but it's called Drops of God. And I will admit, before doing the interview with Ed, I had not heard of it. Somehow this had escaped my purview. Deb, you're already quite familiar with this title, I guess.
Oh, this has been on my wish list for a long, long, long time.
Right.
I love this one.
Well, you're a wine person.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those rare moments where my interest in wine and my interest in manga come together so perfectly it's scary.
It'll have your face stamped on the cover, relevant to my interest.
I mean, I just went to this show at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and they had this show called How Wine Became Modern. Mm. And there's this whole section about, the cult of wine appreciation. And there's, Kami no Shizuku, Drops of God there. And there's a scene that the book is open to that talks about Screaming Eagle, which is this cult wine that costs, gosh, like $1,000. Like, it's a really expensive, culty Napa Cabernet. And so it's interesting, because what Kami no Shizuku did was, wine is not native to Japan. There's not a native wine tradition. There's a sake tradition. So, and that's true all over Asia. There's not really this native appreciation of wine as an everyday drink. Whereas I think what Kami no Shizuku did is that it's by Tadashi Agi, which is basically a pseudonym of, basically the name of a brother and sister team who both really love wine. And it made wine very accessible and interesting and fascinating to people who normally thought wine was very snobby, very, you know, hard to get, made it dramatic, and they explained they would actually feature real wines that you can buy at a store, and they talk about what it tastes like and why it's special, and decanting wine, all these things about wine that in a really fascinating way. So, I mean, Kami no Shizuka has been made into a TV drama. It's been named by Decanter magazine as, like, which is a big wine magazine, like the top one in one of the top 10 most influential forces in the wine world today. Because any wine that's featured in Kami no Shizuku is a bestseller all over Asia, Korea, Japan, China. It's amazing.
Yeah, Ed mentioned that must be why every time I go to Japan, I can buy a bottle of Absolut vodka for $13. But any wine is ludicrously overpriced.
Oh, absolutely. It's very culty. I mean, in China, for example, right now, there's a big controversy because wine is considered to be a mark of being a sophisticated business person. But most people don't really understand wine. They just know the big names. So there's this big black market where people buy empty bottles of very expensive wine, refill it, recork it, and sell it. That's just how weird the wine world. I mean, right now in the wine world, the prices are being hugely inflated from Asia because all of a sudden there's all these people in Asia who are utterly now fascinated by wine and they want to buy the best. They want to impress their clients, but they kind of don't know about wine, so they just go for the big names.
So they're suckers.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. So you see, this is Kami no Shizuku is a really interesting manga in that. It's very different than how we think about comics in America or even how we think about manga in America, where it's just for kids. Kami no Shizuku is basically influencing worlds outside of the worlds of comics. And that just blows my mind. And I'm so thrilled that they're having this because this is one of those books that has been on the I want to see this published in America, but everyone says it'll never happen because it's a long series, because it's very esoteric. But at the same time, New York Times has written this up, Esquire magazine. All the food blogs have written this up, and every time it does, I used to cry a little inside because it would create all this interest in this manga, and no one could buy it.
Yeah,
and
wow.
That just killed me.
That's really interesting to me. And just a brief little history lesson. How long has this trend been going on?
Kami no Shizuku has been on people's radars in the wine world for at least three to four years.
Okay. Because it immediately brought to mind that the Japanese were remaking Sideways, so that must have been sort of part of that.
Exactly. Very much a part of that.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. Ed, are you excited about this? Are you curious?
I'm curious. I'm not a wine drinker, so... but I always find it fascinating to read these kind of manga, because I do learn something, and then the next time I'm getting invited to a party and I have to go down to the liquor store, at least I can make an educated guess as to what I'm buying to bring to the party.
Right.
Because there have been other things like Cup of Soup manga. There's been Deb. What was the food manga that Viz just did?
Oishinbo.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't like most Japanese cuisine, but that was a fascinating read to see the details behind food preparation. And it was a great drama between father and son too.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot about you know proper way to cut fish, why that's important. You know, I mean, things that we think are done for show,
mm-hmm,
are actually have a significance as far as not just presentation, but preserving the taste, keeping it fresh, and so yeah. I'm just utterly fascinated by that because I'm happy to eat cold pizza in the morning. So I'm not.
No, don't get me wrong. I eat as much as the next person too, but you know, like wine is such an obtuse subject, and it always seems so snobby and so full of its own vocabulary, and it's a rich person's thing. But Kami no Shizuku makes it very accessible and exciting.
It's a little impenetrable, but mm-hmm, I think. Personally, like right now is probably they couldn't have picked a better time to bring it out.
Mm.
If only because and I live in Southern California, so I understand that I do not live in Minnesota, and I am breathing rarefied air here. But when you go any grocery store here, especially like a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods, they have six-pack carrying cases for wine in the gigantic, unending wine section. And I see middle-aged folks and you know the kind of rich senior type where they've he's in his 60s and he's wearing a polo and he clearly runs a mile runs through miles every morning, probably lives on a golf course. He's crating 12 packs of wine out of the store. Mm-hmm. So I know it's still a huge culture. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it seems like kind of a no-brainer, and that kind of ties into what I was going to sort of lead this into, which is the slow but noticeable growth of foodie manga that is slowly being brought out here. We're seeing more and more of it, which I think is a really good idea, because Deb, you're probably the best person to speak on this, but isn't it almost guaranteed to get noticed by the foodie world?
Oh, absolutely. There's a cookbook store in San Francisco called Omnivore Books, and then I went to another cookbook and cooking store in Toronto, and you know what they had on the shelf? Oishinbo.
Right.
And I was thrilled to see that. I've been evangelizing this. I mean, because I talk with wine bloggers and food bloggers. I send them copies of Not Love But Delicious Food. I send them copies of Oishinbo. I said, you got to see this. And I feel like that's what manga does really, really well, is it expands what people think comics can talk about. I mean, to take it slightly off topic, Wandering Sun, for example. I mean, transgender tweens. There's no comic out there that talks about this subject at all, but manga does it. And I think that's where manga can really grow in America. When we can show readers who normally don't even read comics that there's stuff that it's not just big eyes and explosions and giant robots. It's about everything. And there's a manga out there for you that you would really find fascinating.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled he's doing this. I'm really excited about this because it's something I've been bugging him about for a long time.
I think it's easier to convince people that, especially with stuff like this coming out, much easier to convince people that manga is not a genre than it is to convince people that anime is not a genre. I think that's just easier across the board.
I just wish this happened earlier. You know, I mean, like this. I mean, that wine exhibit in SF MoMA. If that manga was available now, it would be selling in the bookstore of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. You know,
right.
And that just makes me sad that opportunity is missed, because manga's not. You know, at a certain point. Manga is, you know, like when we're just catering to the same small group of otaku and teenagers and sort of, it's not going to grow. You're just going to it's going to be like superhero comics in America, where it's just caters to that small group of overgrown teenagers who never gave up their love of superheroes. It needs to be I feel like in Japan and in Europe, it's comics is for everybody about everything. And that's the only way it's going to grow.
Ed, you were going to say?
Oh, well, I was going to just ask Deb to talk about the winery in Napa Valley that she went to, that's owned by one of the founders of Capcom.
Oh, yes.
Talk a little bit about that, because I just happened to see a video podcast on on it this year, and I was really fascinated because he bought it, he maintains it, and then I was trying to remember, I think 80% of what he bottles gets shipped back to Japan, because in the interview, his vision was to make Napa Valley wine more accessible to the Japanese and much more affordable. Because it's interesting what you were talking about, Deb, how it's become kind of this connoisseur's market. Mm-hmm. And this seemed to be one of the things he was trying to combat, was to make wine much more affordable so that it was on, it could be on everybody's table if they wanted it, so that it wasn't just for the people who could, you know, chunk down $150 for a bottle.
I don't know if you're talking about the same guy, because Kenzo Estate wines are very expensive.
But that's what he said. Now, I mean, that's what he said in the interview. Yeah. I mean, that might not be true simply because of the market over there, too.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, those are exquisite wines. They're all amazing. I went to the opening reception up there, and it's a beautiful estate. This is when you go up there, you realize, oh my God, Street Fighter made a lot of fucking money. Because it's a beautiful estate. It's acres and acres, and he got the top names in wine to help him build this beautiful caves and estate. And but I mean, I bought the half bottle of wine, and that was $40.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's only the Sauvignon Blanc, and that's the low end. Most of his wines are, I mean, exquisite wines in beautiful cedar boxes with silk scarves, and it costs $200-$300. That's impress your client wine.
Yeah.
Not chug. That's not $2 chuck you drink with a pizza.
Right, I was going to say, so in Japan, they're not quite at the days of 200 yen chakusan yet. Not quite yet.
Chakusan. Nihyaku chakusan, ne?
Right. So that's an interesting growth market for manga. And that, you know, the foodie stuff, it's a good growth market. In a field where, and you know, I'm talking to you guys coming from where my entire career focus has pretty much been anime, and I mentioned this on our last podcast with Sean Kleckner, how everything happens to the manga industry a couple of years after it happens to the anime industry, and I think 2011 is going to be a bad year for you guys. I think you're gonna have our 2008, which was an awful year, and I'm curious if you guys are sort of reading the tea leaves and looking how the wind is blowing, and we'll start with Ed here. What do you think is going on? Because we're getting rumblings out of Borders. We're seeing publishers shut down. This looks like the anime apocalypse from 2008 happening all over again to manga. Is that your read on it? What do you think?
Well, I mean, manga has been on a steady decline since 2007. It was interesting.
I would call it a decline. I'd call it a correction, honestly.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would be a kind of harsh correction because in 2010, manga sales were 50% of what they were in 2007. Mm. So, I mean, manga 2007 was kind of the high watermark for manga. And then you've seen approximately 20% drop in sales. 2007 to 2008 was huge, and then 2008 to 2009. I'm hoping actually we're going to be start leveling off, and I'm kind of hoping because Vertical and Dark Horse were actually the two publishers who showed growth last year. That maybe that's a sign that some of this more wide ranging manga like Chi Sweet Home is going to start helping the market kind of expand itself. But yeah, it's been a tough 3 years for manga. So, but I would agree with you, Zach. I mean, I it's really interesting, to see that some of the mistakes that the anime licensors were making in 2004, 2005 were the mistakes that manga licensors were making in 2006, 2007. And it's interesting to see who gets to survive and who doesn't. So, but with book, well, I mean, with unfortunately, with book sales in general down, and
don't forget the economy being pretty much sucking.
Right. Well, yeah, and then graphic novel sales are down too. So, you know, manga is getting hit in the middle of this kind of everything moving to digital trend, and so I'm kind of interested to see what happens with like Viz and Yen now that they have iPad apps to see if they give us the numbers. And this is, as you know, it's always hard to get numbers from companies, physical sales versus digital sales, to kind of track that trajectory to see what consumers are doing in 2011, 2012.
Well, here's the problem with iPad. Here's the problem with saying that iPad's going to save the manga industry. iPads are expensive. Yeah. I don't own one yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Really? It's a tax write-off for you.
whatever. I'm saying most teenagers who can't even afford $50 to buy 5 volumes of manga a month are not going to plunk down $500 for the lowest end iPad. iPads are mostly for older readers, you know? So
Apple enthusiasts.
It's pretty new.
Yeah, well,
at a certain point, I mean, most kids who read manga like to read it online. And right, I mean, I can, and they want to read it online, and they want to read it free, and they want to read everything, you know? So they want, so right now the manga industry is not set up for that yet. Right now, every single manga company, manga publishing company, Japan included, has their own platform, has their own website, has their own policy on what's free and what's not. It's very disparate. I mean, so it's still being defined. I'm glad to see that the manga companies are finally, both in America and in Japan, are figuring out that online, they have to offer some kind of online digital solution to readers. But I think it's still not sorted out yet.
You know, that's an interesting point, and it suddenly made me think, realize that this is not premium content, and it's not treated or seen as premium content by its chief consumers. Mm-hmm. Aside from super fans and, you know, bloggers, it's not really seen as super premium content. So when you talk about the cost of entry, the iPad is about as much as the PlayStation 3 was when it first came out. Mm-hmm. But kids would fucking kill themselves for one of those right when it came out, and they're happy to pay $60 for a new video game. But the iPad, as if you view it as like a console for manga, like a video game console for manga, I can't see them wanting to pay for the content once they have the iPad.
Well, you know, if you look at your average video game, you get hours of enjoyment out of one video game.
Sure,
right?
Sure. No, I understand the difference.
Given volume of manga, you'll maybe get half an hour.
Right. Exactly. I totally understand the difference. But even 99 cents, I mean, the platforms have driven the cost of their own content down so far to where anything over $1 is deemed unobjectionable by most of their users. I bitch about paying 99 cents.
The market is going to sort itself out, and then the pricing will be there, and the volume of content will be there. But right now, it's very early.
Yeah.
Right. Well, no, I would agree. I mean, a good example, and I don't want to be a naysayer, but the one initiative right now that's guaranteed to fail, I'm going to give them 2 years at the most before they either go to an iPad app or they just end up folding into what Yen Press and Viz are already doing, and that's Square Enix. Enix,
what the fuck is up with those guys?
That is the absolute worst launch I've ever seen for digital manga. This idea was tried a few years ago and it failed. And everybody who tried this idea got burned. And that was this idea of, look, you come onto our website, you pay for content, you're not allowed to download it. We will hold the content on our servers. You know, it's like walking into Barnes & Noble, buying a book, and they say, okay, well, we'll keep it in the store. You can't take it out of the store, but you have your own private bookshelf. And anytime you come into the store, you just go over to your private bookshelf and you can read your book. You just can't leave the store with it. And
you can't share it with anyone either.
Yeah, you can't share it with anyone. And it's not PayPal compatible. They decided to go with some third party that I've never heard of, who I'm sure that they use a lot in Japan. But it's like you walked into the American market and everything that the American consumer wants from a digital product, you've simply chose to deny. So I can't see how that's going to succeed, and I'm sure they'll blame us for it because, you know, we're just being, unreasonable, demanding Americans. Thank God, though, that Yen Press and Viz sell their stuff so that, you know, when this thing tanks, you'll be able to get Full Metal Alchemist through Viz's store, and you'll be able to get the rest through Yen Press. So
The problem is that as soon as you get the Japanese companies into the picture, I just think they're still trying to figure out how to deal with the internet. You know, I mean, they don't know how to monetize it. They don't know how to control it. The fact that they don't know what readers want out of an internet type experience, and to manage their intellectual property without it being pirated. I mean, it just feels like the blind leading the blind at this point.
Well, and again, can't help but look at this and say, welcome to streaming anime circa 2008.
Yeah, exactly.
You look at the exact same thing.
Has anime figured it out yet?
Anime hasn't figured out, nobody has figured out how to monetize streaming anything. But anime is getting, I mean, look at this last season, 14 new shows, 11 of them available immediately, simulcasted. That's good. Like, I'm happy with that. I'm not expecting perfection. They have at least said, okay, here you go. Here's your product. Here's what you want. It's free or mostly free, or you can subscribe to us for $6 and get it. They've done pretty much what the market has suggested they should do while still trying to make a little bit of money on this product that they are selling. Not the ideas that should be free or whatever fucking internet libertarian bullshit you want to peddle. If manga is in 2 years where anime is now, I'll be thrilled, but I know that market is much older. The people at the heads of those companies are much less open to the ideas that people are throwing around about how to make the internet work. All I can do is sit back and say, like, well, see you guys in 2 years. You know, like, yeah. have fun. Have fun at the end of this year talking about how we're all fucked.
And right. Well, yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I remember because I interviewed the Kungao from Crunchyroll, and he was talking about how he was working with Bitway, and they were going to create this one single platform for publishing manga online that all the Japanese publishers were going to use. And then you look on the other hand, you see Dark Horse has their own proprietary platform. Tokyo Pop is using Comixology. Yen has their own proprietary platform. And Viz has their own proprietary platform. So it's, you know, I mean, if you're the average reader who's been relying on, say, your Manga Fox or your One Manga, it's like, what the fuck's the problem, man? I could go to Manga Fox and One Manga, and I could read everything. One platform. I could switch. I didn't need to care which publisher it was, you know, who created it. I could just switch from one to the next kind of like going to a Netflix site. Like, this is the way things are now. It's like, imagine if there was a Netflix for every single movie studio. And every single movie studio site had a different player that you had to download, and you had to pay a different pricing structure, and you got different picture quality out of each one, and you had to pay them all separately. That's what manga's going through right now. And it's a really horrible experience. And that's why people still, until manga has figured out what people want and are willing to pay for, like an iTunes type experience, like a Netflix type experience, and not be so proprietary, you know, I mean, we're just going to be where we are.
Ed, anything to add?
It's interesting, for my 2010 Year in Review podcast, I actually went back and was doing a little research on manga on the internet, because I remember when I was first getting into manga around 2000, for those who remember way back in the dark days, there was a publisher called Comics One.
Mm-hmm.
And around 2002, which is about the time I discovered them, they were actually selling PDF books. And I remember I got like the Joan manga, and they did a Jesus manga. And I think I bought all four of their Tomei volumes. And they were PDFs. And you just downloaded them. It's a shame. My computer crashed a few years back, and I lost those. Because I wanted to see what quality the PDFs were. I'm pretty sure they were probably like 30 DPI or something. But, I mean, but at a time when manga was selling for $10 cover price, they were selling the PDF versions at half off. And it was PDF, so you just downloaded Adobe, which was free, and at that time was still available even on Apple, before Steve Jobs went megalomaniac on us and decided he wanted to own the universe. So it was essentially available as an open source once you bought the material. Mm-hmm. And it was just interesting to see how ahead of the time they were, and then other faltering attempts to digitize manga that have all failed subsequently. Net Comics is the only survivor standing that still does like chapter rentals at like 25 cents a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and it's a good, I mean, I enjoy the reader. Some people find it a little clunky, but you know, when you're paying 25 cents a chapter, it's actually nice. You know, I mean, you can check out three or four chapters of a book for less than a buck and decide whether or not you want to read the rest of the book. And even if you read the rest of the book, again, it only ends up coming out to be like $5. And for most of the stuff that they publish, it's not stuff I really want on my bookshelf anyways. I mean, it would be stuff I buy and then end up giving to a friend or donating to the library. So that works well for me.
I forgot to mention eManga, Digital Manga's website.
Right.
I mean, then they have their own proprietary player as well.
But yeah, I mean, it is a nightmare, the fact that, you know, if you want to do something, you know, to read manga online legally, you know, for me, I don't own, the only Apple product I own is my iPhone. So Viz and Yen are kind of currently out of the market for me. Comicology I can use. Dark Horse is app is PC available. So, but it is a nightmare to have like eight different programs loaded to my computer, so I can read eight different publishers.
Right, and there's Libra, who only does it on Kindle, and there's Comic Loud, who only does it on Kindle. So there's the market is so fractured right now. I mean, because everyone's trying to figure out who's going to own this space.
Is it Yowie? Yowie Press seems to be one of the few people, and they're on Kindle. But they've built a really hardcore fan base, and they do really well on Kindle. And people will tell you Kindle is not the best device to be reading comics on, but they're offering at a price and a convenience that their market will accept. So,
well, keep in mind too that in certain markets it's very difficult to get boys love manga.
Right, you know? That's true too.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, when we're talking about the closing, like, if God forbid, borders closed, went out of business, the Boys Love Manga companies like Digital Manga really suffer because Barnes & Noble doesn't carry those books. So, I mean, if you get the Digital Manga newsletter, they put it out there. They said, you know, borders is in trouble, man. And if you want to keep getting these books and, you know, it starts getting harder, you can always come to our website, which is akka.com, and buy it from us directly because we'll always have it. But they're basically putting it out there and they're saying, you know what, if borders goes down, we're going to suffer.
Well, that was my next topic in terms of the 2011. Correct me if my hunch is wrong. For manga pundits such as yourself, would borders shuttering be a bigger story than a publisher closing?
Oh, heck yeah.
So that would be really, that we're really talking about the shit hitting the fan.
Doing massive returns, that killed Go Komi. That killed Aurora.
Well, I mean, what's interesting, though, is I went over to ICV2 to see what I could find out from their numbers. Mm. And with the closing of those companies, it's interesting that really killed off Borders' market share in manga, because at one point they were 40% of the manga market, but last year they're down to 20% of the manga market.
I wouldn't say it was just those companies closing. I said also, you know, like Tokyopop was affected, Viz was affected.
Oh, right.
All of these companies were affected when Borders did massive returns, and so what they did was they basically cut back. If you follow this stuff, you notice that they cut back their publishing lineup considerably. Tokyopop delayed a lot of releases. They've cut down on how many new titles they put out a month. All of them did. All of them.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. For 2010, industry-wise, was looking pretty dire in the summer because you had Viz did the massive layoff. Tokyo Pop was cutting back production and talking about the print-on-demand option for some of their lower-selling series. Again, like I said, I mean, the only people who were reporting up numbers were Vertical and Dark Horse. It has been... 2010 was a tough year for the market. Had, what, three or four small publishers disappear. So, that's That's why I'm thinking if 2011 is worse, then you know there could be a real question of whether manga will survive to see 2012, because
Manga will always be around, but I think what Dark Horse and what Vertical did very well, and even like Drawn and Quarterly and Fantagraphics did, they released fewer volumes and they marketed them thoughtfully. They marketed each book as an individual. Whereas I think what other manga publishers did wrong, they carpet bombed the world with manga. And they didn't, like, you know what, sometimes what I find very frustrating is, like, sometimes I'll ask, like, don't just give me the title of the manga. Tell me what it's about. Tell me why I should care. Tell me how I can describe this manga to a potential buyer reader who might want to buy it. Instead, all I get is a cover art and a title and an artist, and I got to do all the rest of research myself.
And that's coming from the PR divisions of these publishers.
You don't just throw manga out there, have something that looks manga style, and expect people to just buy it blindly.
Right.
You don't just carpet bomb the world with just manga. People don't buy manga just because it's manga. People buy manga because it has a good story, or it's interesting, or they like it. The world has expanded to the point the manga market, there's so much out there, and people only have so much money. You just can't, and half the time the manga's shrink wrapped. You can't just expect people to buy manga just because it's manga. That's dumb. Right.
Well, no, and again, going back to the boom, the 2007, at that point, you had somebody like Tokyo Pop was literally putting out 10 volumes of manga a week. because I used to, because I've always gotten the preview comics catalog, and it was the Tokyo Pop section was just insane in 2007. It literally got to the point where, unless you were independently wealthy and when talking, like, you would have had to be making like $200,000 plus, you simply could not buy all of what Tokyo Pop was publishing each year, because they were just publishing so much material. And then add on top of that, you had Viz, you had Seven Seas. You had all these other publishers doing their thing, and you just flooded the poor market. And like Deb was saying, unfortunately, the PR got used to the fact that they were putting so much product out at one time, they just couldn't afford to do those kind of write-ups because, they were, as soon as they got like one newsletter done, they were already behind getting the next one out. And like I said, for Tokyo Pop, 10 a week is just insane. Mm-hmm. But that's what they were doing, trying to read.
The hardcore fans are going to cry, like, why isn't every manga in the world that gets published in Japan every day come here?
Exactly.
But, I think to succeed in the American market, you have to market each book as an individual. And, I think, for example, Vertical gets a lot of press because they put out one book every couple months, and they market it. And they say, here's what's special about it. Here's why you should love it. And they make very careful choices about what they decide to pick up. So you look to their brand as being, if they chose to publish it, it must be pretty decent.
Yeah, I think Ed Chavez has done just an amazing job as marketing director over there. Not only for the stuff that's coming out, but even doing a good job promoting their back catalog.
Yeah, all right. Hey, Vertical didn't pay for any advertising on this.
But the same thing goes for, like, Fantagraphics or for, like, Last or, like,
I'm just kidding.
Drawn Quarterly. Kidding. They take a very curated and careful look at what they decide to put out there.
Right. And like I would say, Zach, I'm not sure if you've gone to, like, a Vertical panel, like, at a convention. Because they're only going to be talking about three titles, they get a whole hour to talk about three titles. You go to a Viz panel, and Viz is going to be talking about 20 titles.
Fucking PowerPoint
presentation. But they're also talking about not just manga. They're talking about their anime products. They're talking about their magazines.
Exactly. And the merchandising, else they've got going on there.
Well, Vertical's operating. Vertical's figured out, here's how to run it as a niche. Here's how to market to the right people. Here's how to sell to the right vendors. Viz is a big company with they used to have lots of employees. Now they have half a lot of employees. So it's a completely different business model, and Viz is much more concerned with the total mainstream audience. They want Saturday morning kids buying Saturday morning toys and Saturday morning comics. So it's totally different. It's a totally different thing. But now I get what you're saying. It's much easier for a manga fan to figure out a company like a Dark Horse, or even a Fantagraphics now, or a Vertical, than it is to figure out, like, what is this company publishing that I'm going to be interested in? Because I know exactly what you're talking about. I've sat through those Viz presentations, and it's just like, we're releasing this, click, and then this, click, and then this, click, and it's like, I don't know what any of this stuff is, and you're not telling me.
So. Right. I mean, usually that's what I do when I do my reporting on the new licenses. I actually stay afterwards and ask them, so what's this book?
Yeah.
Or I got in trouble once for not looking online. Like, what is this book about? And I'll try and look up and see what it's about and try to explain, because I don't assume that everyone has read the Scanlation.
Well, it's not just. Do you think there's a little bit of a leftover idea among the people? Because these are PR folk. Mm. Their job is just to promote, sell the books. Is there a little bit of a leftover idea that, well, it's manga, manga sells, just push it out there. So long as the cover is splashy, has big eyes and a fucking magic stick on it, someone will buy it.
There is a little bit of that. I mean, it's. I think that's a mistake. I mean, just to assume that.
Of course it is. Now.
All I have to do is announce the title and when it's coming out, and you guys will all buy it. No, it's not like that anymore. Come on. Give me a reason to care. Give me a reason to put down $10.
Well, and I agree with you. And I think, a good example is I would love to see Viz be much more intentional in their marketing for their signature and their Sig Icky books, because they have an audience. It's a small audience. I mean, most of it's the reviewers. We love the stuff. We talk it up, but you know, we can only do so much, you know, to promote the book. And it would be nice to see Viz spend a little bit more money, spend a little more time on some of these, like, because I'm looking at Children of the Sea Volume 3, and I'm thinking, it's a beautiful book. It's well written, beautifully illustrated. It's mature storytelling. There's no reason why Viz should not be selling this book outside of the traditional manga market. Same with Pluto would be another example. Viz should have been pumping that.
Pluto reached outside of the traditional manga market.
It did. It finally reached into the sci-fi market, which I was really happy to see.
Mm-hmm. I saw like C.B. Cebulski tweeting about it, like saying he would read a volume and he would be crying on the subway train. And you know, I mean, that's what we have to do. I mean, if you think about it, like when I look at superhero comics and I look at that rack, I don't know what to pick up. Look at all of it and go like, you know, I don't know what's good. So I'll count on a few key tastemakers to tell me, here's what's awesome in superhero comics, here's what's awesome in indie comics, and here's what you should pick up.
I do that too. Like, I mean, I used to work at Wizard, rest in peace. whenever I want to know what comics to read, I ask Rob Bricken over at Topless Robot, like, hey, what's up? And he'll give me a short list of, well, here's what's good, check it out. And I'll just do that, because I have no idea what's good or not. I mean, I know there's a couple of writers that I'll follow. Mm-hmm. But, I understand that total, like, it's there's so much, and you have no idea where to even start. So it's hard to even put your toe in.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the things that Deb, what you're talking about, is just a problem that comics in general still have in America, and that is this perception that they're more than juvenile fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, even with some of the, like, let's say some of the inroads, let's say that Watchmen did, the kind of the perennial bestseller for comics. It's still, Watchmen is seen as like this insane exception, and so they draw a little box around it and they go, okay, well, you know, here is the one time that comics wasn't for kids, so we'll put that over here on its own shelf, and forget that they're Oni Press or Drawn and Quarterly or Fantagraphics is publishing all this material that is equally as mature and nuanced and all that as Watchmen, if not better than Watchmen, in my opinion. And they just ignore it. Like, oh, well, that's comics, and comics are for kids. And it's like, ugh. So, you know, like you said, with manga, in Japan, everybody just accepts that you can do manga about golf, mahjong, being a a Yankee mom, just anything you want. You know, there isn't any subject that they can't make a manga for. And to get people into that mindset in America is still a huge uproad battle. And I just...
But that's where, you know, I think everyone has to do their part.
Right.
Like, I mean, I've bought several copies of Not Love But Delicious Food, and I sent it to my friends who love food and don't read comics. You know?
Right.
I've given, like, copies of Children of the Sea to my indie comics friends who think manga is Naruto. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a matter of, as a blogger and as someone who loves manga and wants to see it grow beyond just being moe shit. Sorry.
It's all right with me.
I think we just have to... We have to open people's minds, you know, and we're in a position to do so.
So, right. Okay. So, before we get to Twitter, and we got to get to Twitter, I wanted to ask very briefly, what do you want to see from book publishers going into 2011? We've already discussed how they really need to sort the digital mess out, because digital is a mess right now. They need to sort it out. But moving forward into 2011, what do you want to see the publishers doing? What should they be doing more of? What would you like to see happening in 2011? Ed, go.
I guess what I'd like to see is, I guess, better marketing, like Deb was talking about. Just to see publishers kind of do a multi-layered marketing to say, okay, you know, we have books like Ouku or Children of the Sea, which are probably not going to appeal to the teenage audience. They're not quick-paced. They're very nuanced, very complex reads. So we're gonna be hitting the adult market, and we're gonna do something that says to adult readers, look, try graphic novels. You're gonna find them just as satisfying a read as a regular novel. And here are some examples. And here are why, you know, here's what's great about them. And at the same time, you know, reaching out to more teens and then reaching down to kids. I would like to see the kids' manga expand a little bit more. We're making inroads to some extent with Chi, Yatsuba, but I'd like to see a broader range of that kind of all-ages manga get out there. And then... You know, I would love to see more back catalog stuff, more historically significant stuff come out, but I don't want to bankrupt anybody. So I have to kind of admit that what we're getting at the pace we're getting it is probably as good as it's going to get. And I just kind of have to bide my time. And, you know, you keep your wish list and you just say, okay, I can check off one more of the 8,000 items on it. And let's just hope that I live long enough to see the rest get published.
Or you could just learn to read Japanese.
I know.
Seriously, I mean, it's like, when I go to Kinokuniya and I look at all the amazing manga there, I'm almost kind of glad I don't read Japanese fluently. Yeah. I can read Japanese and I can understand Japanese, but I can't read fluently. And I'm grateful because if I could, I would be fucking broke.
Right.
Because there's so much amazing stuff. And I go like, oh, you know, I love this stuff. So what the American publishers put out now is enough to keep me engaged and entertained for now. If I had to buy everything I loved, I wouldn't have money for food.
Right.
You know? And maybe this is the pace that our market can support right now.
So you think right now we're seeing a market correction that's appropriate for the times?
It kind of is. I mean, just because, well, for print. At some point, there will be like an online pricing structure. There'll be a unified online pricing structure that'll make it easier to consume a lot of content at once at a reasonable price, like reading it on your cell phone, reading it on your iPad. But we're not there yet. And it's quite a mess. It will take some time. Given all the with low sales, no company has the marketing budget to sell each manga as a precious jewel that must be seen by a certain specific market. You know, it's just not going to happen. That's something that I consider my job to do, to spotlight what is great to people who normally would not see it. But I just feel like at a certain point, rather than bitching about what's not out there, I can't read, you know, Saint Onii-san. You know what? It's probably faster if I learn Japanese. And I accept that.
All right. Well, all right then. So, Twitter. First up for Ed from Stabkid. How does it feel to be so hilariously wrong about Fractal? No, I'm just kidding. That's a joke. That's not a real question.
Okay. I'm telling you, Jack, Fractal's going to change the way you see anime. One day you're going to say there was pre-Fractal anime and there was post-Fractal.
I didn't even get to see fucking Fractal before they pulled it.
It's back now. You can see
it.
Yep.
Oh, well, it my bad.
That was I predicted that would be a short conflict, and it was. Okay, from Mark FBR, you guys know this guy. Is Akamatsu's ad-supported site a good potential way to keep newer generations of fans reading an older manga?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, I think it's great that he's doing it. But again, what you're dealing with is a fractured experience.
Yeah, I would kind of like to see him succeed and for that site to really grow. Of course, I would also like to see it succeed in English, because currently it's a Japanese-only site, although it isn't region-locked, which I'm very happy for. So even though I can't read it, I mean, it's at least a way to look at what is out there. And for some manga, you can get a good sense of the story without having to read all the dialogue. So I kind of hope that Ken has his finger on the pulse of where the market is moving. And I actually think he's a lot smarter than people give him credit for. I think he sees trends a little bit maybe sharper than I think most people are willing to admit, because they are not particularly fans of Love Hina or Negama. But he said some pretty perceptive things in the past that have turned out to be true. So... I'd like to see that. I mean, I'd like to see that site kind of take off as an example of what publishers could do. Because again, as long as you've got a computer, you can access it, and you don't need it. You don't need to buy a special. You don't have to download device. Any programs or a special device. You can just read it just from your Internet Explorer. So, That's interesting, and it's interesting that he, was willing to kind of put all of Love Hina up for free, which apparently still sells. I'm always amazed that book still sells after 10 years. You figure everybody
who never grows old.
I guess, well, but I figure at this point it's got to be like people who own it who have like so read it that their books are falling apart that they're buying replacement copies. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think he's just doing it as a proof of concept because he owns the rights to that, so he didn't have to negotiate with anyone to do that.
I think his
heart's in the right place, but I don't think I seriously suspect that. And sorry, Japanese friends who are reading, who are listening to this, who understand English, I think the Japanese companies just do not get the internet, and they don't get intellectual property management on the internet. Sorry.
Well, Ken Akamatsu doing this is Radiohead giving away In Rainbows for whatever price you feel like paying for it. It's sure. Kevin Smith deciding to, quote-unquote, distribute his own film, which is just four-walling. It's somebody with an audience that's already made them rich deciding that now they can give away their shit for free or through a different means. It's not for new artists. It's not for new anyone. It only works if you're already rich and famous. And that's great. And that's great. It's great that he's doing it, but... You mentioned it's a proof of concept. It's not a proof of concept for anyone except Ken Akamatsu. Like, that's it.
True.
From Yuri Khan, Erica, she wants to know what you guys think are the most important and fun parts of your work as journalists/reviewers. And let's start with Deb.
I personally find it very rewarding when I get comments from people who say, normally I don't like manga, but because of your reviews or because of what you wrote, I read something that I really loved. Can you recommend something else? And that, to me, makes my day.
Ed?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's very humbling when somebody says, I wasn't going to give this a look, but I read your review and I'm going to try it. or, you know, if I'm reviewing Volume 4 and somebody comes up and says, you know, I got Volume 1 because of your review and I've stuck with the series and, you know, I really like it. So, you know, thanks for letting, you know, thanks for turning me on to this series. Yeah, that's, it's very rewarding. The fun part really is, been podcasting for me, getting a chance to like sit down with other reviewers and just talk about what we're doing, this, you know, discussing one book with, you know, three or four other people, getting a chance to see it from different perspectives in a, and then having that kind of real time interaction as opposed to, you know, somebody writes a review and you read it, then you think about it and maybe you post some comments and then they post comments to your comments. That kind of just, virtual face to face has been very rewarding, this past year.
Okay. All right. From Curiosity, that's Lisa. For the manga fan, what North American conventions would you recommend? Any best for industry, vendors, or personal favorites?
You want to grab that one, Ed?
Gosh, you know, that's a tough one. Because manga generally tends to get treated as a stepchild at most conventions. there is Manga Next is trying to become a much more significant convention. Last year, it seemed like they did fairly well. I'm kind of interested to see what their lineup for this year will be. So that might be something to look forward to. The hard part is, like Anime Boston, because so many of the, seems like so many reviewers live in Boston, and because it's not that far from New York City, has been getting some good, panels and discussions going. But again, that's kind of just taken off in the last couple years. I mean, there's things that happen at like San Diego that only happen at San Diego. There are people who only go to San Diego.
That's my personal favorite, actually.
Yeah, I mean, well, you guys like, you know, Bill Flanagan does the Lost in Translation panel there, and he gets like all these, you know, great translators who've been doing it for a decade or more. They have a great discussion. It's really frustrating because that's the only convention that they do that panel at. Mm-hmm. And guys like Carl Horn only go to a couple conventions. Like one is
Anime.
Yeah, and well, an Anime Weekend Atlanta. I mean, for manga, it tends to be a little frustrating.
It helps if you like comics in general.
Like, it does.
For me, my personal favorites are Toronto Comic Arts Festival, which is all about creators. And it has a wonderful community and it's very exciting. I mean, I went when Tatsumi came. It's a really nice vibe. It's a set in a library at the Toronto Public Library, and you get all kinds of people. You get to meet comics creators up front and personal. Whereas I think a Comic Con, for example, is a professionals con. If you know what to look for, you'll see people from all over the world there, and I think it's a good con for pros. As far as like being displaying as an artist, I would say TCAF, Toronto Comics Arts Festival, is really great. How is Otakon, by the way? I've never been to Otakon.
Yeah, I mean, for manga, Otakon's kind of a desert.
oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess I can skip that one.
Well, I mean, Otakon last year was lucky. Ed Chavez came from Vertical, and he had Felipe Smith with him. And the only reason that worked out was because literally a week prior was San Diego. And so Felipe was already in America. It just made sense to kind of keep him over for a week and to ship him over to Otakon. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas if Otakon had been maybe even like a week later in the schedule, then I don't know if Ed or Felipe would have shown up. So,
I mean, I kid about Otakon, but that's probably the biggest reason they don't get a lot of publishers because of San Diego, because everyone's at San Diego. It's why I don't go to Otakon, is because it's right after San Diego.
Yeah.
Well, and the problem is it's not just San Diego, but it's also Anime Expo. So you've got within three weeks prior to Otakon, you have the biggest convention in North America, period. And then you have the biggest anime convention in North America. And then Otakon happens. And it's like most people are just so exhausted from doing those two shows, they just don't have anything left for Otakon. And My impression, and this is just a personal opinion, is that Otakon is shifting away from a focus on industry and shifting back to a fan focus. It seemed like that this year, and I was kind of getting a vibe that they were going to do a little bit more of that next year, that they're not really going to worry about getting publishers and licensors there. If they show up, they show up, and that's great, and they'll give them room, but they're really not going to focus on that. They're more going to be interested in getting fans to do panels, panels that celebrate fandom itself. So,
well, that's part of the byproduct of, you know, manga not selling that as well as it used to, is that the marketing budgets are slashed. So they're not really doing as many, manga publishers aren't really doing as many cons. They're not exhibiting at them. They're not bringing their artists as special guests. I mean, I think at this point, what I've noticed in a trend, and I've only been, you know, working as a journalist, going to cons as a journalist versus going to cons as a fan, that any big name marquee artist who comes to America is only probably only going to go to San Diego Comic Con and maybe Anime Expo.
No, they take them to San Diego. They hardly ever bring anyone to AX because it's so close. The audience is much bigger. I mean, Viz takes everybody and everything to San Diego, and it makes more sense. And I mean, that's my answer. Like, if you're a manga fan, just try. It's too late now if you want to go to San Diego, but you could try.
Oh, no, tickets go on sale next week.
Okay, right, but Deb, where are you going to stay?
Well,
because those hotel rooms are gone.
Hey, but Deb, remember, all the four-day and all the weekend passes are sold out.
That's true.
And I think Friday and Saturday actually might be sold out too already.
Probably. I don't know. I get to jump through the re-register thing. You know, Deb, every other year.
New York Anime Festival and New York Comic Con is trying to do something.
I know I'm keeping my fingers crossed about it, but what
I really like about New York Anime Festival and New York Comic Con is they know the culture.
That's a good show to go to as well. I think a lot of publishers show up there because a lot of publishers are on the East Coast already.
They're based in New York City, yeah.
So it's good. Well, okay,
and I'm really interested because of their numbers from last year to see who shows up this year, because they are now the second largest convention in North America. So I think, you know, guys like Viz who didn't show up last year may not feel as comfortable ignoring them this year.
It's not a matter of ignoring it. It's a cost. It's a cost. Yeah. Do we want to ship our booth from San Francisco to New York? But anyway, we got to get to the next question. So, okay. Cutting you off there. Scott Speziani. What's the best series to give to someone who doesn't read manga? Ed, go.
One series? That's kind of hard. Chi, I think, is a great icebreaker. Pluto, simply because it's science fiction, if that's what they're into. It's kind of hard without knowing like what the person likes. Because like for somebody who is into superhero comics, it might be a different recommendation. It would be something from Shonen Jump, because I think that's a similar culture to superhero comics. It's, you know, good versus evil, people with special powers. It would depend, I think, a lot more on knowing what they like and what they don't like. Full Metal Alchemist, I think, is actually a really good one. In fact, I can say I turned a comic book reader into a Full Metal Alchemist addict, so that's a good example.
I think you have to kind of treat it like being sometimes I think of myself as being like a manga sommelier. You know, you have to ask people, like, what kind of comics do you like? What kind of books do you like? What are you interested in, you know?
Yeah, what kind of stories, yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, for example, for a lot of people who normally read superhero comics, sci-fi. I mean, I've recommended Biomega, for example, and they love it. Or Pluto, and they love it. Or say, for example, the food bloggers or the wine bloggers I talk with, I give them Oishinbo. Or people who like indie manga, maybe I'll give them Children of the Sea. Or I'll give them Solanin. Really, I mean, manga is not one size fits all. I have to ask questions like, what kind of books do you like to read? What are you interested in? And I can give you a good recommendation. But I can't give you, like, this one manga that everyone will love.
Right, right.
I think that's a good answer. So from Togane to Achi, is the death of the physical manga a certainty? And if so, how long before we're just totally digital? Best guess.
I don't think we'll ever be totally digital, honestly. Because one of the problems with digital is, like, there was this other manga site where, and they went out of business. And once they went out of business, your manga was gone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think the same thing goes. Like I say, for example, even though until they allow you to download and own that property instead of relying on going to their site to be able to read it, like Square Enix does, you know, I mean, I don't think print will ever go out of style. There's some, its sales will decline, yes, definitely, but I still buy CDs because, you know what, I'm kind of pissed off that Apple will only let me play it on 5 devices.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying.
No, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to have to pry books from a bibliophile's cold, dead hands. So there are always going to be people who like the physical medium, myself included. I mean, one of the things is, even though the iPad's nice and I played around with it a little bit, even though I don't own one, I still don't find it as comfortable to read as a physical book. There's still a little bit of an eye strain, at least for me personally, and I think for some other people. And even though the Kindle and the Nook are trying to alleviate that to some extent, it just doesn't replace the physical page. You know, digital's great, but it's not as detailed as analog. And so you're always going to have the people who want that analog experience.
I think you're still going to – it's going to be very similar to what happened with the music industry. You know, there are some people who are going to want to have the CD, the physical object. But you want the physical object when it's something worth keeping, when it's something mm-hmm. exceptionally good. Like, for example, I don't generally buy a DVD unless I really love the movie and know I want to watch it more than once. Whereas I'll watch a lot of things on Netflix once, and you know what? I don't care if I never see it ever again.
Right. I think the general consensus is that physical media is not going away anytime soon, probably not in the foreseeable future. It's going to be part of media buying for years and years and years to come, because sometimes I just want a magazine for the plane. I don't want to have to worry about my battery running out or it not being available. I just want to buy it at the fucking gift shop and read it on the plane, and that's it. And there's a lot of people like me out there.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
People magazine.
Well, no, and actually, I'll give you exactly what you're talking about. I mean, one of the reasons I like going to used bookstores is because I can go buy a sci-fi paperback for $1. I can throw it in my pocket, and then if I'm tooling around New York City or DC, I mean, I've got that one book. I know it's going to last me several hours of reading. I only paid $1 for it when it's done. Man, I can just leave it somewhere. If I lose it, I'm not really going to cry about it. So
I don't think physical media is ever really going to go away, but I think it is in serious decline, and that's why we were talking about borders.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So from Real Car, how long do you think it's going to be before almost all manga releases are 2 or 3 volume omnibuses? Are we going to go to box once again, following the anime market, going to box set releases rather than single volumes?
I don't know if it's ever going to be all omnibus editions, but I think it's common knowledge that with the reason why, for example, a lot of long series don't get licensed in America is because the given knowledge is that anything longer than several volumes is going to sell less and less and less with each successive volume. So, for example, Okiku Furikabute, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but you know what they call it, Big Wind Up, has never been licensed in America because it's over 20 volumes. And so, you know, like manga publishers will look at it, hedge their bets and go, you know what? I don't think it's going to sell consistently over that many volumes. Only Bleach and only Naruto and only Fullmetal Alchemist can sustain sales over 20 volumes. So they don't. So the omnibus editions allow publishers to have fewer volumes on the shelves, hedge their bets, and somehow lessen their risk. I think the omnibuses were, I think that was the big trend of 2010, where you saw more and more of that. That was a way of them hedging their bets. But I don't think you're going to see that for every single title.
I don't think you're ever going to see anything for every single title. But I can see more of this happening, and you know, we're definitely seeing lots and lots of re-releases that way.
Sure. Like Sasameke, for example. if they only are like Cross Game, for example, is sold as the first volume was sold as a 3-volume omnibus. Mm-hmm. Each subsequent volume is going to be sold as a 2-volume omnibus, and I think that's smart because I love Mitsuru Adachi, but I think you really need those you get hooked when you read those first 3 volumes. You don't get hooked by reading just that first volume.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Shintaku wants to know if print on demand has a future.
They ever figure out their delivery system.
And the quality, I think. Yeah, I think if print on demand, one, if the price point's right, I think Tokyo Pop's price point's a little high at this point. And if you know that the book you're getting is as good a quality as the stuff you're buying off the shelf, then people won't have a problem with it. Just unfortunately, it hasn't been around long enough to know yet.
They're still sorting things out. Like, I remember seeing like a tweet from someone saying like they got their print on demand from Tokyopop and it was not even manga. It was not even the books they ordered. It was like a person, the company that was delivering it sent them 3 prose novels that they didn't even order. So I think there's still bugs to work on.
Yeah, it sounds like.
I didn't hear that story.
But I will say that I've been looking for Basada Volume 19 for the past 3 years, and I haven't been able to find it. And it sucks.
Okay. All right. From Danielle Adora, do you think apps like Viz's iPad app are helping to stop scanning, or is it too little too late? And does the manga community have a real chance to make a stand against piracy, like how video has with easier legal ways to access it? Ed, why don't you take this one?
I mean, I don't think the iPad app is going to do much to stop scanlation, because we've already discussed that. It's the device itself is just way too expensive. And then
free is a very good price.
I know. And the other thing is it's not all of Viz's catalog, so
it's not the latest stuff.
It's not the latest. I mean if you could do something like Crunchyroll, let's say, where you're paying $7 a month and you're getting, I don't know, essentially Shonen Jump and maybe Shoujo Beat, and you're able to read those in like the chapter by chapter format, that might work. I know that actually what's interesting is Renee has worked really well for Viz.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something they're giving away free, and yet look at the New York Times bestseller list and all the volumes have been on that list. So again, it's just a question of.
Or Hetalia is another good example, right? I mean, Hetalia, they're offering it through Zinio. They're offering it through Comixology. And it's selling consistently well.
Exactly.
That's been a long-time scanlation hit.
Right. Yeah, like you said, Deb, I think it's frustrating because on one sense I just get a feeling from the Japanese companies is they don't trust the American market. They're just expecting us to be pirates and thieves. And if that's what you expect, we can live down to your expectations. But I think with something like Renee, we can live up to your expectations too. I think there is a solution. It's just unfortunately the Japanese companies haven't figured it out yet. But they're trying. But something like Renee is getting close to the answer.
It's a lot of work. I mean, I remember talking with Mike Montesso when he was working on editing Renee, and he basically worked a 7-day week.
Yeah.
It was very tough.
And it is.
If you times that by how many titles that Viz puts out, and if you times that by how many Shonen Jump titles that fans want to see in America the week that it comes out, that's a lot of manpower. That's a lot of hours. I think fans' expectations are very. They don't take that into account.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I'm the fact that we're getting 11 simulcast anime out of 14 is amazing. When I think about the manpower it takes to be able to get that, get that done, because they're doing that on a weekly basis, and that's That's burning some midnight oil.
Yeah, well, ask Justin how tough it is just to do two on your own. It's not fun. Okay, from Real Car, why is Ramna One Half popular enough to still be in print, but Urusei Yatsura isn't? First of all, I didn't know Ramna One Half was still in print. That's a surprise to me.
No, I think it's hard to find.
Maybe that's not accurate.
Well, Urusei Yatsura is an older series.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And it looks it.
Yeah, that's old, and it's an old harem show. I mean,
what's really funny is when I've talked with a couple of comic artists, like I've talked with Brian Lee O'Malley and a couple of others who, you know, aren't really, you know, they're not necessarily known as being manga consumers, but that's their gateway drug. Ranma One Half is frequently mentioned as a gateway drug to manga.
And it was for me, so.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm hoping that some, you know, like Viz doing their Viz big editions of Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, Vagabond, and eventually they'll do Ranma One Half. But I mean, saying like, why is Ranma One Half more popular than Urusei Yatsura is like asking like, well, why is Blackjack in print and why isn't Princess Knight in print? It'll happen. Just be patient, or go to a book off and buy the used versions. But you know what? That's a non-question. I'm sorry.
He'll know now. okay. From Ketamine's Lover, if Tezuka has had success with his manga here, this is a similar sort of question. If Tezuka has had success with his manga here, why can't Cyborg 009 creator Shotaro Ishinomori have the same?
I have one response for that. Because Vertical puts the time and effort to market it and treat it with respect. Versus Tokyopop's handling of Cyborg 009 was way before its time. And they weren't able to give it the kind of attention and the kind of prestige formats. They weren't able to sell it and really show off that Shotaro Ishinomori is a true innovator and legend and someone who's worthy of your respect. It was put out at a time when Tokyopop was trying to publish tens of manga a week, you know, so they couldn't market it as with the kind of respect it deserves. It was before its time. I think at some point maybe someone will showcase Shotaro Ishinomori's work and give it the kind of respect it deserves. But you know, only this year we're seeing Shigeru Mizuki's work done by Drawn in Quarterly. So just be patient, you know. I mean, as more people grow up with manga, as more people read manga and start to really love and appreciate its history, you'll see that. I mean, you see like Fantagraphics puts out prestige editions of Gasoline Alley or the Peanuts manga, Peanuts comics. That takes a certain amount of time of fandom where you know the history and you appreciate the history and you want to read it. I think manga is very young in America. Manga appreciation is very young in America.
Okay, from V-Guy, he wants to know what you think the best way to represent regional accents from Japan is in print manga.
Ooh, ouch. You want to take that one, Ed?
No. to be honest with you, I don't know. Because anytime you try to equate it to a regional accent in America, you bring in the American cultural baggage. Mm. And so I almost think it's better just to translate it all as straight English and then to footnote it. Because you know, if you do an Osaka accent as like a Southern accent, there are implications to that that aren't meant to be part of the Osaka accent. And at the same time, there are implications of the Osaka accent that aren't going to be captured by making it simply a Southern accent. Mm-hmm. And it's really weird to watch. And companies have at this point really butchered it, because for some companies an Osaka accent means Brooklyn, for some companies it means Texas, for some companies it means Georgia, and so you know, at this point in manga, when people are like, okay, well, they talk weird, I guess this is Osaka. You know, I mean, that's the best that I can do at this point, unless it's something like Helsing, where the guy's Scottish and you give him a brogue so thick you can't read it.
That's probably a question better asked to say Mari Mari Morimoto, who did the translation for Ayako, and or Safe William Flanagan, who is a traditional translator. I mean, this is that's more a translator question. That's a very difficult decision to make. Or even Pancha Diaz, who had to deal with all the backlash from the translation of Ooku, and having them speaking in Shakespearean language. It seems off. To me, it takes me out of the story. Like, I'll read, like, for example, the translation of Vagabond, for example, speaks in a very natural language. And so I can get into the story, and it's not disruptive at all. Versus Ooku, which has this faux Shakespearean language. Or in Ayako, where it has this faux Southern accent. I don't know what the right decision is. I think that's probably a translator's question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you because I agree with you on the straight English thing, because the context and other elements in the story and the setting and characters should tell me about their character more than their accent, because it's just distracting when you're reading something. You're reading an ancient samurai saga set in Edo period Japan, and someone wanders in and says, "Well, howdy, y'all!" And it's like, what the fuck?
It's very odd. I mean, I think like Andy Nakatani, who's the translator for Vagabond, chose the right approach, because I can just get into Vagabond, and it's not disruptive at all. Versus I found Ooku to be a little hard to get into.
Well, and it's interesting because Bill Flanagan has actually had a discussion of not like how do you equate accents, but if you're going to give a character an accent, how do you write an accent?
Right.
Because part of the problem is that if they decide they're going to go with, let's say, Brooklyn equals Osaka, then they give them they try to give them like some, you know, James Cagney Brooklyn accent, or you know, something like really thick, and Bill was really good in just saying, look, you only have to throw in a select number of words, and people will fill in the rest for it. You know, you just need to give them key identifiers to say this is a Brooklyn accent, and just every once in a while you throw in that Brooklyn pronunciation, like Boyd. You know, you don't have to make every word accented.
It's a very difficult decision to make. I think you've gone too far when you've taken the reader out of the experience of the story.
I agree. Okay, guys. Well, that about wraps it up. I cannot thank you both troopers. Thank you so much for being here and coming on to chat with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thanks very much. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Okay, that's our show. I want to thank Ed Chavez, Ed Sizemore, and Deb Aoki for joining me this week. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week.